This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Thank you all for braving the dangers of the new year. Come and practice together. We had a relatively long break over the holidays. Several days in a row with no formal practice. It's unusual for us. Here, at least recently, the tradition is pretty regular. Practice of Zazen and service throughout the year. Other places, as you know, they have periods of varying intensity. So maybe they'll have an ongo or a training period, and then they'll have an interim where there aren't any formal periods of Zazen scheduled. Mostly we don't do that. I've been living this way for long enough that without that physical engagement, sometimes I feel a little bit drifty. Kind of, what am I doing here? Feeling. But because this is a temple, we have various places where the body of practice manifests, such as, for instance, in front of the Kaisando altar, the founder's altar upstairs. And we have the guardian kings inside the front door, mostly whom I forget to bow to. And I noticed that just the over those period of few days, the gassho tezu, as they say, means gassho, and tezu is bowed head, has the feeling of zazen, actually. Even without the steady foundation of our sitting practice, this body of practice wakes up in just a bow. And this directed me again to the mysteriousness of this life, this human world. So much that we take for granted. We assume that the world is a certain way because it's relatively predictable. And Sir Isaac Newton, among others, made their fortune on how predictable the world is. And of course that's still true. But somehow some other people came along and said, Maybe we're not looking deeply enough. So over the holidays, inspired by the example of Kato-san, I was binging on YouTube and watching science films, which are really quite fascinating. There are hundreds of them, thousands maybe. Mm-hmm. So I have a new hero, Brian Greene, you know him, mm-hmm. physicist. He's also cute. In addition to being, you know, I thought, oh, well, he's just a popularizer. Apparently, he's quite a bit more than that. He's a, you know, teenage math genius. So in addition, although his field is physics, he's also a powerful mathematician. And clearly, people have been using the intellect to continue to look deeper. Since the human sensorium is kind of, in a manner of speaking, limited is not quite the right word. It sort of has its place. It's kind of a fixed place in the scheme of things. In order to look deeper, they come up with different gadgetry. So now they have this huge thing in Switzerland, which is looking deeper than anything else ever has. And they're trying to assemble a coherent picture of how things look at the limit, you might say, of physicality. And in so doing, they kind of discover that physicality is not exactly physicality. It was interesting, in all of these films that I watched, these videos, there was not one mention of Richard Feynman, which surprised me because he was such a significant figure earlier in the latter part of the 20th century. But he was not mentioned once, even when there were Feynman diagrams being displayed. They were never identified as Feynman diagrams. He, as you may know, was he was another math genius. And he was one of many people who said, quantum mechanics, nobody understands it. They understand the mathematics up to a point, but what exactly that means, no one seems to be able to figure out. But he would often say, you don't have to worry about that stuff because really, as far as our actual life is concerned, it's irrelevant. But some other folks actually are saying, actually, that is not right. Because there is no divide between what's going on at this level of the infinitesimally small and our actual macro world. There is no divide. So then some of the current crop of physicists got together and they were talking about the next gadgets they're going to build, which are even bigger and even generate more electron volts. So they will look at even smaller things. But the mysterious quality of our life that we actually can feel is reflected in the fact that the closer we look at stuff, the more it seems to vaporize. And in spite of poor Professor Einstein's feeling that there's something wrong with quantum mechanics, it just can't be that way. Unfortunately, he was wrong. the universe is just as mysterious as quantum mechanics makes it look. Now, in the meantime, of course, we are also encouraged to turn the light of intellect, the light of mind, on our own experience. And in so doing, come to intimate appreciation of its own mysteriousness, its own ultimate ungraspability. And when I hear quantum physicists talking about their work, I keep hearing in my own mind the Yogacara insight that go where you will and look at what you wish, you will find nothing apart from mind. And I would say the same extends to these increasingly arcane experiments with reality. None of it escapes mind. Same is true if instead of looking at the infinitesimally small, you look at the massively large. So there are gadgets that look at tiny, tiny aspects of reality, and other gadgets that look at huge chunks of reality. And again, the revelations coming from these studies suggest that, as somebody said, the whole universe in 10 directions is this body. Meanwhile, of course, various apparent people pop up and then disappear, and then new ones pop up and disappear. And that process also is ultimately mysterious and ungraspable. So we're told, or suggested, you know, turn the light and shine it inwards and illuminate the person. So we do that. And in so doing, find nothing to grasp. An irresistibly mysterious process of arising and passing away, not in chaos at all, but according to, I'm reluctant to call them laws, but according to an ineffable cause and effect that seems to operate at all levels of existence. For a long time, I've thought that those who have the capacity to use mathematics in this way themselves enter a kind of samadhi. And that this samadhi produces insight. You may not think that that's your experience, but I assure you it is. If at the moment you don't think your appreciation is quite keen enough, I would say, well, return to the hall. Like, as they tell us, even if strictly speaking, maybe that's not necessary, but we tend to think it is. So a simple bow evokes the body of practice. The effort you all make to study Dharma with this body mind has incalculable effect. The samadhi of turning the light enlivens the body mind with insight, even if you don't yet appreciate it. So, in a manner of speaking, many, many people are turning the light around and illuminating the person. And their samadhis are producing new sutras, such as, well, maybe this is just one universe. And it sounds so much like the Avatamsaka Sutra that my feeling is this can't be accidental. It cannot be. So here we have a supposedly new year, and I at least, well, New Year's is my least favorite holiday, and whenever it comes up I always hear the old Zen saying, news of the new year raises not a bit of dust. Means, a life of practice just goes on and on, step by step. We don't worry about holidays. The longer we practice, the more baby Jesus starts to look like baby Buddha somehow, and vice versa. And the more the samadhi of what the hell is it called? Kalabi Yao manifolds. Somebody mentioned that in one of these movies, so I looked it up. It was completely incomprehensible. I have no idea what that is or what it refers to. Every other word in the explanation was another word I had to look up. So finally I gave up. But I think it's a kind of samadhi, actually. That's one of, by the way, Brian Greene's specialties is whatever that thing is.
Kalabi
Yao manifolds. Apparently that's two people, a Mr. or Ms. Kalabi and a Mr. or Ms. Yao came up with these things.
Oh.
And there was a picture of kind of a multicolored blot on the screen. I thought, I guess that means something to somebody. But it, you know, could be a multicolored blot plucked right out of the Avatamsaka Sutra. Even if the late Professor Feynman were here and said, don't worry about this stuff. It doesn't have any meaning for actual life. I would say, I'm sorry, I think you're incorrect. All due respect, Professor, I think that's wrong. many, many ways of, as we say, studying the mystery. Lately, I've also been delighting in the insights of Dr. Carl Jung, who was another samadhi knot. And his insights are equally breathtaking and startling. So in this new year, I just want to encourage us again, keep studying whatever way you wish. Keep letting the light turn and illuminate the self. And of course, when this is illuminated, that is illuminated. Ha! Objections, comments, yes?
Just noticed that, well, I have two. First one, I noticed that earlier on, there were kind of action words about turning the light and producing samadhi and doing, and then later at the end you said letting the light turn.
Yeah, I think that's better.
Okay, that was my first question. The other one was, sometimes I think about the schedule here, well, I think about the operations here all the time, as you know, but sometimes I think of it as like, maybe the ongo feels a little pressure cookie sudden. Maybe the steady, ongoing, maybe more constant schedule here feels a little like a gradual.
Well, it was pretty clear that Suzuki Roshi really wanted people to establish a daily practice that was so reliable that they hardly had to think about it. He seemed to feel that that would be the most helpful thing. So for many, many years, you know, the monastics at Tassajara, really semi-monastics, only two sesshin a year. And now, I guess they're trying to do this sesshin a month thing, which I think is, it's not quite our way, myself. It's just my feeling.
It seems to be an enthusiasm for retreats.
It does seem to be.
In the American Buddhist
In American circles. Buddhism in general. I think that's right. Yeah. I think that's right. Because then people can like, okay, I've got this chunk of time I've set aside so I can go practice. And then the rest of the time, well, you know, I've got my family and job and so forth. And that's certainly one way to do it. One of the challenges there, of course, challenges is, okay, how do you integrate this thing into your life such that once you finish a retreat, you don't find yourself, oh, I'm longing for my next retreat, which is 4 months off. It's like, oh, wait a minute. You know, especially in Zen, you don't try to encourage that sort of like, oh, I love my retreats kind of a thing.
I've heard people say exactly what you just said.
Yeah.
Many people say that they never go to retreats.
Yeah. And most of the people who can afford to do that are fairly well off, it seems to me. You know, retreats tend to be really expensive. Not here so much, but many places, you know, hundreds of dollars are involved both for the dana for the teacher and paying for the retreat and then room and board and food and so forth. If you do that several times a year, that's a huge chunk of money for a lot of people. So meanwhile, there's this kind of seemingly, you know, undramatic plodding day after day, breath after breath practice that, at least in my experience, eventually sinks in very, very deep. So that a simple bow wakes the body of practice, or reminds one that it's there, and that it's there always. And reminds one to let the light turn, rather than, okay, I'm going to do something about turning the light. All you got to do is close your eyes, and the light turns. The eye of practice finds nothing stopping it. It just goes and goes and goes. Yes.
So, something you said reminded me of Samara Chogyam Trungpa, say, or, right, which was vaguely Vajrayana's right name. Basically, that every bow and every sort of time you offer incense, engage in those types of practice, that increases your debt to the Buddhas and ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say you agree with that?
Yes. Enthusiastically. Yeah. Yeah. One comes to have the feeling that the debt is will never be repaid, except by continuing to incur more debt.
I think I need some clarification.
Yes.
So you're practicing, you're doing some kind of practice, and that practice increases debt? Is that?
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. Making offerings to the Buddhas and ancestors is actually a gesture of gratitude. So in a way, it's also repayment. But to the degree, for instance, that we're not entirely... What if there's a little bit of residue of, I'm offering to the Buddhas, then there's a little karmic spin in that. Rather than, as I say, doing the prostrations, this body, other bodies, not to. This is more the mind that the Buddhas and ancestors invite us to embody. No Buddha, no offering, no offerer. Then there's actually no karmic spin. And this actually repays the Buddhas and ancestors, the debt we owe them for the teaching that we received. So that's one way to look at it. Does that clarify it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Doctor, are you shaking your head in dismay?
Probably, yeah.
Yes?
Yeah, really.
Yes. Good.
Yeah, I mean, just the idea of receiving teachers from Buddhas and ancestors is so very different from science.
Mm.
That's to even start to. You know,
but what about scientific lineages? There are such.
Yeah, and they come and go. But I think what they have in common is hypothesis testing with external verification.
Hopefully, yes.
Yeah. You don't get to say, this is my experience, therefore it's right. Or this came down from Freud himself, or from you know, Newton himself, or from Einstein himself.
I
don't get to say that for very long.
Yeah, we don't either, I hope.
No. Right. Didn't I just hear it? No.
Did you? What did you hear?
Buddhas and ancestors, teachings handed down from Buddhas and ancestors.
Yeah, and the teaching is, see what you can do with this. If nothing, well, too bad, throw it out. That goes all the way back. So there's this whole business of, you know, shruti, right? The received oral instruction, but Buddha doesn't say, and you're stuck with this.
Well, but even if Buddha said you were stuck with it, you would be stuck with it, right? Even if Buddha said you were stuck with it, you wouldn't be stuck with it.
No, you wouldn't, unless you believe that, I guess, and then you might be stuck for a while. And some people do seem to take a rather severe line, like this is the Buddha Vachanam. This is Buddha's words, and you better treat it as such.
Mm-hmm.
Alas, we do find that. Not around here, I hope. So I always have mixed feelings when someone says, oh, you know, the recorder didn't work again. Part of me goes, yes, good. And part of me goes, oh, my legacy is being squandered. Too bad. But it was interesting watching a number of these videos where there were several scientists in a panel talking with each other. And there was substantial disagreement, active disagreement. One guy was all, shut up and calculate. And the other guys are all, no, these theories are extremely important. And they went back and forth and back and forth. It was clear that they had their own take on things. But they all agreed, more or less, that let's keep looking at this. And when our mathematical tools kind of hit the wall, which they seem to do from time to time, let's keep looking. Now we'll build a new gadget and look even deeper. And then the ineffability of the universe asserts itself over and over again. I think nowadays, if Sir Isaac Newton were around, or Professor Einstein, they'd both kind of just throw up their hands and say, you know, I guess you guys are onto something here. We can't even really predict the path of a baseball. How would you measure exactly all of the vectors involved in launching that ball? Well, of course, if you could, but who's ever done that?
Why would they want to?
And why would they want to? Except to demonstrate that classical mechanics works in the sphere of classical mechanics, and that there's something else. In the very large, they say, relativistic space, in the very small, quantum reality. And here we are, somewhere in the middle, practicing the Buddha way, or not, as you choose.
Yeah, I just want to, you know, defend. I don't think very many scientists, certainly not the ones whose, you know, the household names are people who have ever thought, oh, I understand this completely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not science. I mean, nobody does that. It's not something. Einstein said, either everything is miraculous or nothing is miraculous. You know, you can.
Good for him. I never heard that one.
Good for Einstein.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, and good for Spinoza.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said, you know, there are whatever is wonderful and really mysterious about our lives is not something that human beings see with you know, the knowledge of God.
Uh-huh.
It's something that humans see through the whatever lens capability of a human mind.
Yes,
and that's all you get.
Yeah, but
that's wonderful.
What about Meister Eckhart?
Oh, no.
I wish I could say the German. The eye with which God sees me is the eye with which I see God.
Good for Meister.
He was a mystic. So.
Well, I think it's true, but it's not. You know, I mean, if you believe in God and you believe in people, then to say that it's the same eye is a little presumptuous.
Yeah, a little presumption, I think, is part of our human legacy. You could say it's very presumptuous to sit on a cushion and, you know, compose the body, mind, and stillness. Of course, This was Mara's objection. Cut it out, Buddha. You're not allowed to do that.
I have to do it, and it'd be wonderful. But maybe it's Jewish upbringing. But to have the idea that whatever your experience, however transcendent, however connections is between the Avatamsaka Sutra and the scientific view and all that, you ain't God.
You ain't God.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or even if there is no God, you're still not that. You know, there will still be aspects of the universe that you ain't going to get because you didn't evolve to get them.
I'm sure that's right. And yet, we will still look.
Okay.
And look and look. And periodically, strange little Asians like Suzuki Roshi will come along and say, we're always face to face with God. Personally, I think he's right, but what the hell? That's just me.
Well, God can be so many concepts, so many things.
Well, I think he was kind of nudging us away from concepts about God. So, Zen is about, what's your actual experience in this moment?
Did these slide us...
I'm the only one drinking water. Anybody else?
Do they have the idea that there's some limit to their understanding, or do they think human understanding will go on as long as there's a universe and existence?
Most of them seem to think that.
I can see how one could think that, but it seems like there's so much that's beyond our understanding right now that, and the human mind and intellect, there's got to be some limit to its capability, doesn't there?
Well,
I mean,
this is one of the questions that's knocked back and forth. Some of them seem to say, oh, we're never going to actually figure this out. And others seem to think, actually, there is no limit at the moment that I, doctor, whoever it is prepared to accept. Just keep enhancing our ability to look further and further and further. And if at some point, there have been points in the past, just prior to the development of quantum mechanics, people were saying, okay, this is it. We've got it. We've got it figured out. And then all
the smallest particle we could possibly see.
Atoms, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden it's like, oops, wait, there's another, as Master Yunmun said, there is an opening going beyond. So what's that? Well, let's keep looking.
Maybe that's just inherent in human nature, that curiosity to look, whether or not you finally reach a wall.
Yes.
That, forget about the wall, whether the wall exists or not, you just keep...
You keep looking.
Looking.
And I think that's true of Dharma students, too. We're constantly encouraged, don't ever think, okay, now I've got it, now I've arrived.
I think it's interesting about quantum mechanics. Again, probably, if you're not to go with mystical hunches about how science might relate to other modes of experiencing the universe, quantum mechanics becomes very interesting when you introduce the concept of an observer.
Uh-huh.
And what does it mean to say, oh, this doesn't happen until you measure the value?
Yeah.
What does it mean to measure the value?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, somebody needs to say, well, okay, there's a mind there that's competent to it.
Yep.
Yeah.
And without that, what the hell is it?
Right.
There isn't anything.
Right. Well, and it's because there, right, so could it be that whatever's going on out there, we don't know what's going on out there. All we know is our experience of what's going on out there.
Mm-hmm.
And you may want to think, oh, well, that's God's experience. But there's no reason, there's no way to prove that. Right. So it could be that you get yourself into sort of a loop, because what's observing is so those limitations are going to be going to be wrapped around
yes,
there.
But that's not going to stop anybody. Well, it's not going to stop everybody. It might stop some people, but many people will just keep at it.
That's that old tree falling in the forest thing, you know. It's like if there's no one around to hear the sound of a tree falling in the forest, does it make a sound?
Yeah. The Buddhists say no.
I don't think so either. I think it takes people to notice sounds, and it takes people to see quantum particles.
Right.
Of course, there might be a dormouse there to hear the tree fall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's right. But I think it speaks to, the universe is sufficiently amazing within the capacity we have to observe it.
Yes,
that,
I'll say.
But there's still not a reason to imagine that we somehow have the full picture, or can maintain the full picture, or the Buddhas and ancestors had a full picture, or Jesus had a full picture, right? I mean, it's all...
I know, you're definitely in the no full picture camp. I've gathered that over the years.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, maybe that's as good a reason as any to shut up and on.